Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 111 for July 21st, 2011. A new kind of car, industry. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Hey, thanks for joining us for Autoline After Hours, folks. Great having you back with us. And it's great to be with my co-host, who I haven't seen in weeks now, Peter DeLorenzo, the auto extremist himself.
Yes, buongiorno, Johnny. I was gone.
Buonasera.
Lost in the Twilight Zone up at Road America.
Awesome. Well, we had a week off, and then you were bombing around Road America last week.
Yeah,
that must have been a lot of fun.
The big vintage weekend is worth it for...
And just, that's what you were up for, vintage cars?
Yeah, all the enthusiasts out there, if you've never been, you should go. There's four... Well, there's more than that, but there's Pebble Beach, Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
There's Road America. There's the Walter Mitty at Road Atlanta. There's a great event at Watkins Glen. And Labor Day, there's one at Lime Rock. But Road America is the one. If Pebble Beach Monterey is the car event, then Road America Vintage, the vintage portion, I think, is pushing the Monterey Historics for caliber of cars and entries and drivers. And, I'm biased, but I think Road America is the best track in North America. I mean, in the U.S.,
So, did you get out on the track? Did you get to drive?
No, but there were lots of friends running, so it was good. It was very good.
Yeah, you're right. I do got to get out there at some point.
Well, you know, we've talked about that. If there's a sponsor out there, if you'd like to
step... You got some takers.
Yeah, if you'd like to step up, we would go to Road America, to Elkhart Lake. We'd set up shop and do Autoline Sunday shows, and maybe bonus Autoline After Hours, maybe one every day
there
for 3 days.
That's right. All it takes is a sponsor to bring us there.
What have you been up to except go to an Audi event that I wasn't invited to?
Not only did I go to an Audi event, they had it here in town at a Frank Lloyd Wright house that I never even knew existed in Detroit. Must have been commissioned by some woman named Dorothy Turkel, because they refer to it as the Dorothy Turkel House, or maybe it's Turkel, I don't know, but cool little place. Audi had a great little event out there. I mean, I shouldn't say a great little event. It was a chance to talk with some of their execs in a unique location in Detroit that I had never even knew existed.
Was Johan there?
Johan was not there.
Okay.
So don't get too pissed off.
No, I won't. But... You guys know better.
Yeah. Hey, we got a great show tonight.
Yes, we did.
And we got a couple of guests coming on. Later in the show, we'll be joined by a guy named Tom Crum, who's written a book that I'm just really fascinated by called What is Good for General Motors, in which he wants a new business model for the industry, but also wants to get rid of the moving assembly line. That really caught my attention. We're going to have to ask him about that idea. But... right now, why don't we have Duncan Dayton come up, because he's involved in a project that you know a whole lot more about than I do, Peter. But tell the audience who... Duncan, great. Come on in. You got to put a microphone on here. Oh, here. Chip will get it on you.
Duncan has been racing cars most of his life. He has won the very prestigious and famous Monaco... What is it? Historics.
Grand
Prix de Historique. 10 times.
Oh, my God. Driving what?
A couple different cars. Yeah. Right? Go ahead. Tell them what.
All kinds of different cars. Four different cars.
But he's won it 10 times.
The man's a driver.
By far.
A shoe, as we say.
Yeah. And he owned the most successful ALMS team in recent history, which was the first the Acura team. Then it became the Honda Performance Development Team. Duncan's organization, or as we say in Hockey Town, organization, you know, Highcroft Racing, was very
Canadian influence.
Yeah, it was very successful because the initial, correct me if I'm wrong, Duncan, but the initial Acura involvement was DeFerrin.
No, initially we were selected as the chassis development team.
Oh, okay.
Andretti Green was the race team, and Fernandez was the motor development team. But as it evolved over a period of time, Fernandez came in as another race team, and then Fernandez stayed as the P2 team. Andretti went away, and DeFerrin and Highcroft were the two P1 teams.
And you ended up winning the championship back-to-back 2 years in a row.
Yep, absolutely.
So we know you know how to drive. We know now that you know how to build cars and run teams, too. And that brings us to what you're really talking about now, this Delta Wing car, which is one of the coolest race car concepts I've seen.
Now, the Delta Wing car, designed by Ben Balbi, and originally Chip Ganassi underwrote the development, but it was aimed at IndyCar for the 2012 regulations. And I know, John, you and I talked, we just said, boy, IndyCar should go with the Delta Wing
because
it would draw the new fans in and national media attention that was beyond the scope of the typical motorsports coverage. And IndyCar sort of went in the predictable direction with Dallara chassis, which they're using now, but it'll be new, but you can switch out the bodywork.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, yeah, for practical reasons, it was a great decision for on their part, but for the future sport.
But it's not going to move the needle as much as it might have.
However, 2 years later, the Delta Wing project has surfaced again, only this time as an LMP Le Mans prototype racer, and Duncan to take it from there, because there's a twist to this involving the organization of Le Mans.
But before we get into that, just especially for our podcast audience who's only listening, describe the Delta Wing car in case no one's seen it before.
Well, if no one saw it when it first was announced, it's a cross between a land speed record car and Speed Racer, the cartoon. It's very futuristic looking. It looks like a jet fighter. It's got a very narrow front profile.
And a very narrow front track. Two wheels up front.
Two wheels.
Very close together.
Two wheels. When the initial design was done, it wasn't intended to look funky or strange. But form follows function, and over the course of various different design iterations, Ben decided that the narrow front track and the wide rear stance in the Delta Wing profile, sort of like a Delta Wing aircraft, was extremely efficient, and as such is a car that we think has got great potential.
But it's almost like a tail of a wing on it, too.
There is a tail of a wing on it, just which is to help with lateral stability when cars, sports cars in particular, get a little bit of a yaw in it. Sometimes they have overturned, and we're very careful about and conscious about making sure that the safety is there. But it's more about low aerodynamic drag. It's half the aerodynamic drag, half the horsepower, half the weight of a traditional car, half the fuel burn, half the tire consumption, yet still capable of Le Mans prototype LMP1 track record speeds.
And we'll get a bit more into that because that's fascinating. But pick it up from there again, the Le Mans.
So the ACO, the organizers of the 24-hour Le Mans, reserve, there's 55 entries every year, and it's obviously coveted entry. But there's what they call the 56th garage, which they leave open for technically adventurous explorations in technology. The French can kind of go off a baguette with a big block, would qualify. I don't know. But maybe, do they elaborate on that?
Well,
garage?
This is the inaugural selection of a 56th garage recipient entrant. So as such, we'll be the first people to try to demonstrate new technology whereby we actually compete outside of the regulation. So even if we were successful and crossed the line first, we can't get the checkered flag. We can't win. It's more intended.
But the rest of us would know you did.
Right. Well, we've thought about that a little bit. But it's more intended to demonstrate innovative thinking, new technology, and other things that will help promote the automotive industry going forward.
So now you're working with Dan Gurney to actually build a prototype. Is that right?
Yeah, Ben Bowlby is the designer. Dan Gurney's All-American Racers are building the two prototypes that will race in 2012. Highcroft Racing, my team, is the team that's going to operate it and race it. Don Panos is involved with the Reams, which is recyclable energy absorbent material, which is a brand new material that is as strong as carbon fiber but doesn't have the same shattering, brittle characteristics that carbon fiber does.
So it absorbs impact, it absorbs impact.
It doesn't shatter all across the track. And if we decide to build a production run of cars, Panos's Elan Motorsports Group will build those cars.
And the interesting thing about the car to potential engine manufacturers is it will work with a four-cylinder motor. And, you know, since it's not a stress member of a chassis, an engine manufacturer who happens to be building direct-injected turbocharged four-cylinder engines, which is pretty much every manufacturer in the world, and basically the future of this business for the mainstream, for all kinds of vehicles. So this delta wing car with a four cylinder with what, 300 horsepower?
About 300 horsepower.
300, 325 will lap Le Mans within range of the Peugeot and Audi.
And you've simulated all this to get that comparison?
We have, absolutely.
So, but what Duncan's doing now and his organization, they're going out and, you know, they're going to get a manufacturer to dive in and help with the initial development and getting the cars built. Hmm. And then that manufacturer will have a showcase.
No question.
I mean, because
we'll get headlines around the world, whoever.
Well, how many?
We've had 155 million click-throughs on our announcement for the Project 56.
Because you have a really cool video of this on YouTube, and we should tell everybody, you know, go to YouTube and look for, what is it, Delta Wing Cars?
Delta Wing Cars or HighcroftRacing.com. We have a Highcroft Racing YouTube channel dedicated to all the various different videos. But it's really cool. It's a neat opportunity for us, and we're anxious to see how it all works out.
And when you see it, you realize if IndyCar had adapted the Delta Wing, it would really send a message that IndyCar is so light years beyond NASCAR.
They'd be a leader.
But in my mind, thinking about it, I think Le Mans is a more appropriate venue because Le Mans has open-top cars, closed-top cars, GTs, prototypes. It's a much more inclusive formula and a better venue, in my opinion, for this.
Mm-hmm. Plus, it's also fundamentally revolves around overall efficiency.
Right.
Which is another reason why manufacturers are very interested in this project.
Yeah. Now, I get the idea why the aerodynamic drag would be so less, because with that almost bullet nose or jet fighter nose to it, because you've got the front wheels so close together, how do you get to half the weight?
Well, you're taking away probably two-thirds of the front half of the car as far as suspension and whatnot. The other thing is that the three points make a plane, so you really don't need the torsional rigidity in the chassis and tub design.
So the front wheels are so close together, it's essentially like a triangle?
It's like a triangle, and 72% of the weight is on the back axle, so you only need a very thin and light front component to hold the front wheels. The front wheels are laden very lightly compared to the rear wheels.
But I would think that a car like that would really understeer like crazy.
Therein lies the interesting challenge. I mean, a lot of very smart people think, aha, of course it's going to work. And a lot of very smart people go, there's no way that it's going to work. But if you think about a traditional aircraft that we all fly in every day, it is the same layout, very large rear carriage with a lot of weight on it, very light front carriage with very small wheels, closely spaced together, very stable under braking. Or another analogy would be if you think about the jogging strollers that women mm-hmm. run with their children in it. Mm-hmm. Two big wheels in the back, two very small wheels in the front. Very maneuverable, turns quite easily, as opposed to a four-wheel stroller, which you have to sort of crab around a corner. So we're convinced it's going to work, but show up at turn one at Sebring and see if we get around the corner.
That's good. So
we're seeing the
videos on the screen right now. Yeah, Ben's got that up there. So Can you give us any sort of forecast when a car like this might actually turn a wheel?
Well, the current production schedule is slated to have a car to us by the end of October, beginning of November. We'll do a lot of gearbox and chassis dyno work before it actually hits the track, and then we're expected to be on track towards the end of November, beginning of December.
Mm-hmm.
So should be
a very aggressive test schedule.
I mean, with the Acura program, we had about, we were on track by October with a program that had been in development for 2 years ahead of going to Sebring the following year. This time, what would normally be an 18-month or two-year program is condensed into about 10 months. So we're under a very, very tight time scale.
Youch. What gives you the confidence that you could actually be competitive with such a short development time?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of self-confidence in the group that we're doing it with. If this group of people can't get it done, then
who can?
Yeah,
right.
Well, I don't mean to sound, you know, arrogant about that, but you know, it's a bunch
you've
of
got
very
a track record.
It's a bunch
literally
of very capable people who are dedicated to doing this, and I think if it can get done, we'll get it done for sure.
Is there been advancements in simulation and the like too that might help you compress that kind of time frame?
Well, certainly with the Acura program, we ended up doing a whole development of a car totally in the digital domain. And I think the car, the ARX 02A, which we campaigned in 09, was probably the first car ever totally designed in the digital domain without any wind tunnel time. It was all CFD work. And the car came out with a radical tire design, big front tires as opposed to this is small front tires and close together. So we have some experience with that, and we're quite confident that the thing will work. So we're excited about it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Very cool.
Well, cool. We ought to take our first commercial break here and bring our next guest up. But, Ben, let's thank our friends at Chevrolet. Not only does the Chevrolet Cruze offer a ton of features, it features some of the best safety and maintenance in the business. The Cruze comes with rear park assist, which beeps if you're about to back into something. It has rollover mitigation, which means the car senses if it might roll over, and applies the brakes to the outside front tire to bring the car back under control. And it has OnStar vehicle diagnostics, which sends you emails about the latest status of your car. And you can learn a lot more about it at Chevrolet.com/Cruze. Well, we've got a real interesting guest who's joined us here on the set right now, Tom Crum, who's the author of a book called What is Good for General Motors? And, you know, I get a lot of books, and a lot of them end up going into the wastebasket without me spending any time on them. I don't know what it was about this book, but I started to thumb through it before I threw it in the wastebasket and quickly saw that Tom was saying, you know, the beginning of the end of manufacturing in America started when Henry Ford introduced the moving assembly line. And I went, what? This is nuts. You know, this is so stupid. How does this guy possibly make this claim? So I started thumbing more through the book, and about halfway through, I thought, this guy's really onto something. So, Tom, it's great having you here with us on Autoline After Hours.
John, I'm very, very happy to be here. I'm glad you were interested in the book. That's great.
So let's talk about this. Explain why you think the moving assembly line is really sort of an evil thing.
All right. I worked as an industrial engineer and supervising engineers in assembly plants, and I always knew that it wasn't the most efficient way to assemble cars. And as I began to try and figure out what happened to the industry that I loved, my family was very much involved in, I began to...
Let me interject there. You're third generation from Flint with a family that's got a lot of history in tool and die manufacturing and all that.
Yeah. Actually, Floyd, one of my grandfathers, was part of the original incorporation in 1908. He was an original employee. He was a wheelwright.
Apprentice
at Buick, yeah. As I began to try and understand where the assembly line came from, and with my experience with working with John Schmale and Roger Smith on trying to set corporate direction, I began to, somehow I stumbled upon, well, how many cars were being made before the assembly line? And I found that in December of 1912, Henry Ford was building 760 a day, 62 a day. Now that's...
not too far off today's plants.
That's right.
And in fact, the Highland Park plant later did get up to 1,000 cars a day, which is about what we build today in a typical assembly plant.
Yep. But they were doing it without an assembly line. The question is, how could they do it?
Oh, you mean for the moving assembly line, they were doing 700 plus a day.
Yes. And in... they were beginning to stumble. It was getting less and less efficient. Mack Avenue and the Paquette plant, each generation was higher and higher in volume. And the higher the volume, the further you had to push cars to get them out of the way, and it became less efficient. But in January of 1913, after 2 years of saying no to his guys who were trying to experiment with Frederick Taylor's standardized work and towing a car with a rope down through the middle of the Paquette plant, he finally said, okay, let's put in the assembly line. And within...
you're saying his people had developed the moving assembly line. I think Charlie Sorensen was probably involved in that, who was Ford's great manufacturing guru. And you're saying he had to plead with Henry to actually implement the moving assembly line.
Yes. He knew that it would have a change, cause a change in his business model. The heart of his business model was craftsman. He was taking off of what the carriage builders were using. The carriage craftsmen were the heart of the organization. Parts came to them. They would feed back to the maker of components and say, this hole is off location and we need to refine this. And they'd know the operator by name. Charlie, tell Charlie to his fixtures out of alignment or something. Well, that crew, he kept hoping that they would figure out how to make more and more volume. When it finally became evident they couldn't keep up and Chevrolet is knocking on the door with more volume, he waved his hand and they put it in. Within 90 days, he lost 12 of his 14,000 workers.
12,000 of 14,000. You're saying quit.
They walked off the job. They said they wouldn't do it. That mindless task all day long.
Now, I knew that the turnover was horrific, but I've never heard that figure before. 12,000 of 14,000 employees walked out.
I searched all the libraries in the Midwest. I swear to you, I read every book with the word Ford in the title. And not very many of them talk about operations or manufacturing. But when I went to the Library of Congress and spent about a year working in the Adams Building, I began to find that there were other ways of making things, and Ford was adopting the carriage maker's craft system. But when... in 1913, in January, well, it'd be in February and March when they walked off, he rehired, and the new crew wouldn't stay 2 months. He raised the wages 15%. The third crew wouldn't stay. He shortened the workday from 10 to 9 hours. The fourth crew wouldn't stay. So what you do find in modern history books is what happened in January of 1914. He doubled the daily wage. Now, what I've since learned on book tours is he's circulating flyers through other states outside the Midwest and attracting workers who came for the money. And if I could add one point here, the reason there were so many craftsmen here in the Detroit area had to do with Hickory. The reason why all three auto companies are in this region, it has to do with the only stand of hickory in the world was here. And the carriage makers who immigrated from Europe settled into this area knowing they could build a superior carriage.
So hickory wood is the best wood to use in that regard?
It's about flex weight. It's better than English oak. It just, if you want to give your little trotter the slight advantage in that race to town with your neighbor, you bought a hickory carriage. And so this region was exporting to Europe. It was a major exporter of premium carriages from right here.
So Ford starts the assembly line. Most of his people quit. He has to keep raising wages and raising wages. We all know the $5 day, and I do know this to be a fact. You're absolutely right that he had to literally bribe the workers with the highest wages in the world. Otherwise, they would the turnover was that horrific that he had to do it. Then the other thing that you bring up is as we lose that craftsmanship and this, you get this division of labor where if I'm a line worker, I stand in one spot all day long. I do the same repetitive motion day in, day out. I'm not a craftsperson any longer. You describe it as like a cow in a stanchion, you know, just standing there. I describe it as being like a prisoner in a cell because I've worked on the line before and I know the feeling. It's very, very alienating. What you're saying is that alienation is what led to all these labor problems because people no longer came in to work their craft. They came in just for a paycheck. And if you're not, if you, the company, are not going to give me more money, I'm going to form a union and go pry more money out of you.
That's the second generation of those who came for the assembly line. That's where it evolved. It was, the union organizers were there around 1910, but it wasn't until the 1930s when that second generation, it's also partly the Depression, but yes. In comes the union, you got a new generation that wants the next generation of $5 a day, whatever it might be. And you got a management that's got to counter it with an adversarial something. And the two that were most prominent were automation and outsourcing. And the threats of those on the table, well, we're going to automate, we're going to outsource if you don't back down on those demands, led to this loggerhead of the 50s, 60s, and 70s that just, in my generation, took apart what my grandfathers put together. So in the book, I try and go back and describe Henry Ford's original business model using what I learned from working in the think tank and with Schmale's staff. There's just a core of objectives, major objectives. If you set them right, and Henry Ford did, he was the 143rd entrepreneur to come along and try and start a car company, competing with the carriage makers who are dabbling in automobiles. And he got it right. He got that magic set of eight objectives that just worked. Now, he had to refine those. When Durant came along, 1908, he's got to change his envelope, and he did it right. But when he put in the assembly line, he had to change his envelope again. And that's where he got in a little trouble. And the further you get down the line of resetting objectives, the harder it is to go back and change something. And in today's environment, to run it without an assembly line, it takes a different mindset. And that's what I've tried to write, tried to describe.
Okay, I want you to describe what your vision of a new plant would be, but we got to take another commercial break here. And Ben, let's thank our friends at Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com.
And today it also takes unions.
So okay, when Ford switched from the craft assembly to the assembly line, how much less production was there? Was there more initially?
There was more initially because he'd gotten up to 760 a day. He needed more, and the assembly line was more efficient. And there are books about how it was more efficient, which cemented the assembly line as the right thing to do. But if you go back down in volume to a lower scale, which I talk about around 200 a day, 100 to 200 a day, there's a much more efficient way to make cars.
So let's start out with that. You're getting rid of the moving assembly line. How do you build cars?
You see bits and pieces of it. You saw it at Uddevalla with Volvo. You saw it in Spring Hill, Tennessee with Saturn. you, in an assembly line, the car moves, the equipment, the people, and the components are all stationary, and the car goes by and things get put on. Suppose you move the car, you move the people, and you move the components. The only thing stationary is the equipment. And you cluster the equipment in stages of assembly. So you move into an area and you do all the trim. Or you move into an area and you do the chassis work. It's not unlike what happens in your local garage with your mechanic. When he diagnoses that somewhere in the heart of your automobile is the problem making that noise, he takes it apart and he lays it around the room. And when he's got the new part, you'll see him waiting for the part to get there. You'll see him struggle maybe with getting your car taken apart, but you rarely ever see him putting it back together. It's because it's that fast. Because when he starts to put it together, he laid it out this way, he puts it back together this way. Everything goes back in and your car's ready to go.
So you're talking about having like a big room or a skillet or a pallet kind of a thing where the car would be on that. All the people who are going to build the car are on that. All the components are on that, and it just goes to different areas of machinery, whether it's what machine tools or painting or welding or whatever it happens to be.
Tire mounting, bending exhaust system or fuel lines or any of those
things.
That's
kind of like the modern supercar plants, though, right? I mean, the limited production.
McLaren.
Yeah, McLaren. That's what they do. I mean, they move the vehicle to the next station.
Yep. But what Tom's especially keying in on is a team builds one car at a time. And you have multiple teams building multiple cars at a time. But what makes you sure that, because your idea is to build a plant with about 500 people. Today's typical assembly plants are about 2,500 people. So you're talking 200 people that build 1 to 200 cars a day.
Yeah.
Versus 1,000 cars a day in a modern assembly plant by 2,500 people.
Right.
What makes you sure that 500 people can build that many cars a day under your system?
Being an industrial engineer and having struggled with balancing work along a line, where an assembly line is inefficient, okay, is part of it is line balance. You know, you have to put work elements on a workstation. When you add them all up, if it's a one job per minute, it doesn't come up to 60 seconds. It's something less. And the next one's a little more, and the next one's a little less. But the average of that is only around 78%. That's 22%. That's 12 or 13 seconds out of 60 that you struggle to balance. That's an optimal. If you then add to that the time that you spend walking back to the next car, and it isn't just walking, you've got to move the air hoses, you've got to stop and pick up components out of shipping containers, that's around 17 seconds if you ballpark. 17 and 13, there's 30 seconds. That's half the time.
Now, wow.
If you begin to increase and insource instead of outsource, instead of getting an instrument panel fully assembled or seats fully assembled, if you rethink that and you begin to insource it, then you're going to stay longer in station, but you're going to get more content in a very efficient system of assembly. So you end up with, yes, it puts 500 people to work, but you've insourced a lot of the content, so the value to you as a businessman is much higher.
Here's the other thing I'm not sure I get yet, too, is you're talking about slashing the investment cost in building one of these plants, because instead of big automated robotic lines doing all the welding and these, you know, almost like microprocessor plant clean kind of clean rooms to paint the things, you're talking about using CNC machine, you know, computer numerical control machines and other flexible tooling to build these things. How do you make all these different parts?
Okay. I'll give you a machining example, having worked in engines and in transmissions for quite a bit of time. I remember working on a CNC design Mandelli was making machines for Ferrari. So I went over and looked at Ferrari and worked with a good master mechanic out of Mexico and put together a design of an engine plant that used CNC. So the engine block, if you have a rotating fixture, you can get a completely machined engine block out of one CNC machine. And playing around with those machines and learning to program them with Heller machine tools, I didn't mean to promote any special one here, but also going to Japan in the early 80s and seeing CNC equipment throughout their plants. They're already making this evolution, and sorry to say, in the States, we're still buying transfer lines, dedicated automation. If you change the engine, you've got to buy a new transfer line. Or the transmission case, you've got to buy a new case line. If you redesign a car, you got to buy a new body shop. Body shops back then were $500 million, and you just throw it away and you put in a new one. You hope you sell enough volume to recover the investment. Working with Fanuc, again, I'm sorry to use
brand. Robotic company, right?
A robotic company, yeah. Sorry. We worked on a design in which, in a single workstation with a set of six robots, you send in a car, you add parts, you send it back in, a body, send it in several times until it's completely welded together. Unlike a sequential line where, yes, it looks great on an advertisement to see these robots all reaching in together, but they're putting in the same seven welds. Same seven welds. It's just like an assembly line where a worker with a rivet gun or a spot weld gun just puts in the same spot. So the assembly line doesn't work. I say that the body shop robotics don't work. The engine transfer line doesn't work. We've evolved with software, with computers in that environment to where you need smart workers, but there's no reason why you can't build a great variety of cars with the same investment. Hence, the investment is much lower.
So how could this idea get going? How would you envision someone trying out your concept here?
I think there are a lot of ways. It can begin, we talked earlier, about taking one car line and one car manufacturer and just building one of these new plants. But you have to bring it along in a culture that wants it to happen and doesn't object to it. That's difficult for the big three to make that evolution. It can also be an entrepreneurial startup. This could be the 143rd entrepreneur who Tucker and DeLorean, they all tried, okay? But along comes somebody that has the whole business model, and boom, they've got a car company.
So some sort of low volume, you know, I could see companies that build garbage trucks, school buses, that sort of thing, motor homes.
The greater the variety, the better.
Because the way you're describing can accommodate many different kinds of vehicles under the same roof.
It's like my grandfather would equip a wood shop. Now, is it going to make dollhouses or garages? Doesn't matter. With that set of equipment, you can make anything. Same with a kitchen.
I got to imagine, kind of, even though you're only building very few models, that's kind of how you build race cars.
The race cars that we build are very much handcrafted, and I'm fascinated by this discussion because I do believe that there is a lot of value in the pride of workmanship and craftsmanship that goes into building cars. And if you look at the cars from the 20s and 30s from Alfa and Ferrari and whatnot, and maybe in the 40s and 50s.
Or even Duesenberg and
Packard. Yeah. I mean, they are much more evocative of an era, and each one is individual and has a sense of patina that the current fleet of cars that we see in the streets today, I just don't resonate with as well.
Yeah. And it craftsmanship, what I'm intrigued by Tom's idea is if you were able to slowly over time, because again, I don't see it happening fast, not with the big three, you could totally change the culture. I could see where line workers no longer come to work like prisoners and only want a paycheck. They would become craftspeople who go to work on products that, you know, they knew they crafted and would be coming to work out of pride, not just for a paycheck.
The whole apprentice system is something that's been lost, I think, in this country.
It has.
Which, you know, is a great system to train people how to become craftsmen in whatever profession they choose.
Well, that drove the German auto industry.
Still does, to a degree. I mean, they have a much better vocational program than we've got here. We've got it, but we don't push it enough.
It's not assembled in a way that you could build a whole automobile. It's bits and pieces of one. Yes, a collective big enough to make a whole automobile is, it's not a small task. No, you're not going to do it with just one set of 500 people. But if that's a franchise that takes direction from a core that keeps feeding out new designs and new opportunities, why can't each plant build 200 a day of up to 5 to 20 different kinds of things?
20 different models out of one plant per day?
Possible.
See, what I love about Tom, too, is this isn't just, flaky guy that came out of nowhere with this idea. You've got tremendous amount of manufacturing and engineering background. You know, you worked in strategic planning at General Motors. You've got this rich history of your family coming out of tool and die in manufacturing. So what I love about it is you bring this entire historical look at how to really change a business model for this industry. And maybe not just the auto industry. You're saying this could go beyond just automobiles.
I believe it could. It's back when I was still in college at General Motors Institute, I worked on a pipeline, bending tailpipes and exhaust pipes, and each operator would put in one bend and pass it down. And the first time I got a chance to go down with a three-watch board, all I'd learned in school.
And three-watch board, of course, is for the Taylor scientific method of timing, yeah, different things. So
you
that,
can break
just
things,
so people who haven't heard of a three-watch board, right?
I found that the time spent loading the pipe and unloading the pipe was two-thirds of it. The time spent bending the pipe was very small. All the work was in like a bucket brigade. You've got to get the bucket, and you move the water this far, and you got to hand off the bucket. It's easy to train and get somebody working on the line, but it's very costly. I proposed at that time using these index spindle benders, and if the fixture service guy can do it, could you bend the whole pipe in one bender? In other words, just keep sliding it down, putting
with,
a bend
with
in.
One person doing
with
it.
With one person. And he said, yeah, here's how we would do it. Well, 5 years later, 6 years later, CNC benders start by gripping the end of a pipe and just keep pushing it through, and out the other end comes the pretzel that fits on your car. Today, we think nothing of it. All your muffler shops have a CNC bender. Well, I say there's a CNC body shop, there's a CNC, there's a way to do all of it.
Well, this is fascinating. And again, the book is called What is Good for General Motors by Tom Crum. I think he's really on to something here. I would, you know, Dymaxion Motors,
yes,
is going to use Tom's method of manufacturing. And I should say, read the book, because we've only skimmed the surface. It gets deeper into a whole lot of other areas, too. But I mentioned Dymaxion Motors because a couple of weeks ago, we did our own fantasy draft. We each started our own car company. Peter had Renzo Motors. I had Dymaxion Motors. We had Ed Lapham here from Automotive News and Jim Hall, too, from 2953 Analytics. And we each drafted our own executives and talked about the kinds of cars that we would have if we started our own car companies. That's why I'm saying I'm going to use your manufacturing method with Dymaxion Motors.
Interesting. I encourage you to get all elements of that business model.
Yeah.
Manufacturing systems
just
only one of
little
them.
Part of it.
You need the other nine items, too.
Good. So. And go to the book to find out what those items are. But let's take another break and open it up to questions from the audience in rapid fire. Ben, let's thank our friends at Hyundai. Hyundai is known for the great value that it offers, but let's not forget about the technology. The Hyundai Sonata is the first vehicle in its segment with standard integrated Bluetooth hands-free phone It's the first vehicle in its segment with factory-installed HD radio technology with multicasting. And it's the first vehicle in its segment with XM Nav traffic and XM data services. That, plus NHTSA's 5-star overall crash test rating and the IIHS top safety pick, explain why the Sonata is selling so well. And you can check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. Okay, Ben, let's bring up the graphic and get into rapid fire. Okay, this is where we get questions from the audience. We try to rapid-firely answer them back. But comment from Stu, he says, ask Duncan if the Delta Wing will compete in the ALMS or World Championship and if it will be homologated as an LMP1.
We have the clearance to compete in the ALMS, and we may, if we get the right funding, compete in the World Championship. And it, at this point, is unsure what classification it would run in, but I think LMP1 is the right choice.
Cool. Tom Baja Busta wants to know, what's the difference if the car is moving down a line or if the parts are moving to the workstation? Something's moving.
It's more efficient if the car, the people, and the parts are all in the same place, and they stop at a location where the equipment is. It's like being in your local garage. It's very efficient.
Unsprung wants to know, have you ever worked on an assembly line?
Yes, I did. Spent my first year on the assembly line.
I do, too, and that's why I know a few things about this, and that's why I think you're onto something. If GM had, Jonathan wants to know, if GM had not instituted the assembly line, wouldn't have Ford kicked their butt?
The evolution to the assembly line all happened at about the same time. They all made the move. Chevrolet was to a point where the volume was high enough that the carriage system wouldn't work. So, don't know. Without the technology, Ford would have kicked their butt, yes. With today's technology, I would vote for no assembly line.
Jonathan says, apropos of the alienation we're talking about on the assembly line, he says, maybe that's why all those Chrysler union workers are getting high on their lunch breaks. And he may not be that far off on that.
That was, the second official episode in the last, 3 years?
I think just in the last year, isn't it? Maybe 2 years.
Yeah, last 2 years.
Yeah, but, yeah. Ben, I see we got some phoners coming in. Let's bring one in.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. What does the panel think the probability is that VW will sell its shares in Suzuki and walk away? Is it Suzuki will want to tie up to next? Maybe Fiat, or would they rather just go it alone? Bye.
What he's referring to is Volkswagen, I think, owns 20% of Suzuki right now, and they're arguing over what the deal they agreed to is really about. And Suzuki wants to be much more independent, and Volkswagen, apparently, based on what I'm reading, is trying to read them the new rule book. I doubt Volkswagen will walk away from an investment. That's just not the German way. They'll figure something out, and I'm glad I'm not going to be in that negotiation. Ben, let's bring in another phoner here.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan out in Old Japan.
All right, Jonathan.
Great show. So happy I get to catch the live episode tonight. Quick question with GM. Will the 8-speed automatic that they're coming out with be in the Corvette, the Camaro, the ATS, the CTS? And will that preclude an MCT or a DCT transmission for performance versions? Just a quick guess. Again, always fun. Great show. And thank you for all you do. Have a nice evening.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. Peter, you're more up to speed on all that than I am.
I would bet, knowing the players, Mark Royce at GM, if they've got advanced transmission technology, they're going to put it in their best stuff. Now, whether that's the new Corvette, the next generation CTS-V, or the Ultra Cadillac sedan that's on its way. You know, they will employ the stuff. How it affects a double clutch gearbox, you know, I don't know. GM's not big in the double clutch, really.
No, it's not.
And so, you know, they will have sophisticated transmissions. They will approach it differently than others. I mean, but that's part of the business, you know.
That's right.
I mean, Volkswagen Group is big on double clutch.
Yeah, and there's a historical reason for that. Europe never went with automatics. We in this country did. We got billions and billions and billions invested in, you know, torque converters, step gear, transmissions, and Europe didn't need to walk away from that investment to get into DCTs.
So GM's going to put their stake in the ground with a very sophisticated 8-speed transmission, and I imagine there will be 9 speeds and whatever they're going to need. But they'll put, knowing Mark Royce and his troops and his philosophy, they'll put their best stuff in their best cars, and then they'll push it down into the lower model ranges too.
Tom, Jeff W. wants to know, is our educational system geared to produce the workers with the skills to make the process that you're talking about? He says most high school grads today don't know how to do anything with their hands.
Well, that's a good conclusion.
That's a crisis in this country.
Yes. I live in Arlington, Virginia now, and I'm very interested in education. In fact, former John Engler gave me a package to look at. He's trying very hard to make an evolution in skill development.
You're talking about John Engler, the former Michigan governor?
Yes. Yeah. So the answer is no. It's not there now, and it's not just our trade schools. It's got to be a complete rethink of work experience, education experience, like apprenticeship. But it doesn't begin with education. I almost think it begins with a job, or certainly in parallel. If you educate them and you don't have the work environment, then it's a waste of energy.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have both.
Goggles Pisano's got a question for both Peter and Duncan. He says, what do you think of the contact and the passing at the Toronto Honda Indy earlier this month? And there was a lot of contact in that race.
Well, in my opinion, they're guys who are making some dumb moves and starting from too far back, trying to be ambitious. There were a lot of instances where cars went too abreast going through the corners. So I think it's, you know, a typical case in racing where if better judgment prevails, you can do it. If better judgment doesn't prevail, you're going to end up in the wall. And I think IndyCar could do a little better job of policing some of it and handing out penalties in a more more even-handed fashion.
Do you think the double-file restarts is the cause of this?
Well, no. I mean, I think the double-file restarts are great. The fans clearly like it, so I'm an advocate of that. But I think it just takes a little bit of discretion on the driver's part to make sure they get through the corners in a fashion that is going to allow them to go on and win the race.
Especially on a street course.
Yeah,
well, I was going to say, that's what I was going to ask you guys. I mean, those street courses are so tight. There is no room for – I don't like them. You know, the only one I'll tolerate is Monaco because they've been doing it there forever.
Yeah, I agree, and they all suffer from the CSS, dreaded CSS syndrome, which is you can't see shit as a spectator. But you know, I think Randy Bernard's doing a great job in IndyCar. He's trying things, and I think the double file restart is really good. But on certain street circuits, I think it's just a recipe for dumb contact and. You know, it almost, if you have too much of that, it spoils the race. So,
okay, Ben, we got some more phoners. Let's bring one in.
Hey, guys. This is Youngblood in Cleveland, Ohio, calling.
All right.
My question is to Mr. Duncan Davis. First of all, congratulations on pursuing that Delta Wing. And I just had an idea. How about calling Eco Motors and get that OPOC motor? Boy, you talk about revolutionary.
No.
There's an idea. I'm sure they'll be... interested in getting the publicity that it could support or supply. Great show. Good job. Later. Bye.
We just had another question come in, too, via email on that. So
I don't know if you're familiar with the OPOC. Was it?
Eco Motors.
Opposite.
Yeah, opposed piston, opposed cylinder.
Yes.
And it's a new design for an engine that was done by... a guy who used to be the head of engine design at Volkswagen. He did the VR6. He did their first TDI, da-da-da-da-da-da. He came up with a new design for an engine that's half the size and half the weight and less than half the components of a typical engine that we've piston engine that we've got today.
Well, it sounds like it'd be a perfect match for the Delta Wing, and as long as they're willing to write the check to sponsor the program, we're all in.
Right. And Don Runkle, if you're listening, and the other people involved in OPAC Motors, that would be great. Because remember, John, we talked about that for Indy.
Yes.
OPAC Motors should be, you know, doing Indy engines. So here's a perfect opportunity. Plug it into
Absolutely.
The...
And don't forget that Dymaxion Motors is also using OPAC engines.
Oh, that's right.
Another question for Duncan. Who do you have to murder, bribe, have incriminating pictures of to get your car into the Goodwood Revival? Also, would you have any interest in fielding a team in Grand Am or IndyCar?
Well, if you really want to get into Goodwood, it's probably good to have incriminating pictures of Lord March. But they're probably pretty hard to get. He's a great guy, and he's doing a wonderful job over there. It's a great event. As far as Grand Am and IndyCar, obviously, from Highcroft's standpoint, if we can broaden our platform across multiple series, that would be in our best interest. We think it's a very good time to get into IndyCar in 2012 with the more stable platform of coming in on an even footing with some of the other competitors. Obviously, if we're going to do well, we're going to have to compete with the big boys that have been doing it for a long time. So anytime it's more of a level playing field is something that we're going to look at.
Ben, I know we got another phoner. Let's bring that in.
Yes, my name is Tim Driver, and I'm calling from Kokomo, Indiana. Tom, I want to thank you for what you're saying. I've been preaching this my entire life, and I've spent the last 20 years in the automotive industry. Not an engineer, but, you know, I do product development design, but thank you.
Well, thank you for that comment. That's very nice. I've been to Kokomo many times.
Duncan, we got another question here for you. What's the place of driver aids and engine restrictions in racing? How much of the interests of sponsors influence the balance?
Well, I think there's certain things about driver aids that are relevant and appropriate in a racing car to help derive technology. If you think about paddle shift or direct injection or traction control, all are in a sense driver aids that help affect the outcome of the cars that we drive on a day-to-day basis. So it's important to be there. As far as sponsors influencing that, if there's a technical sponsor that's got a particular development that they want to promote, certainly that affects it. But it's more the engineers trying to come up with the proverbial unfair advantage to try to make their car faster. So it's not so sponsor-driven. It's more safety or technology-driven.
Good. Here's a question for Tom from, well, we don't have his name. I think it's Eric. Yeah. He says, I've watched how Porsche built the Carrera GTs with small teams at each station on a super short assembly line. And I've also witnessed the level of pride in the workers at Stuttgart who built the 911s, Boxsters, and Caymans. It's my understanding that the workers there perform a different assembly job every week, and as a result, they're able to build an entire Porsche, a real source of pride for them. Is this typical at a GM plant, or at least maybe the Corvette plant?
In my experience, it is not typical. Having been to Stuttgart, yes, it does come close to having a team build a car. What I'm suggesting is to get low-cost, competitive with imports. You got to think about letting a team of four put the whole car together and move their car, the components, and the workers to each workstation. So at the end, they do the road and roll test. They know if it worked. They fix it if it doesn't. If it bounces back out of audit, they fix it. They take pride in their work, and they begin to build multiple cars per day.
How many people per team building a car would you see?
Roughly six. The idea, there's four working on it. There's one in training, and there's one on vacation. So the experience that Volvo had is once a team begins to work together, they want to stay together. They they have a like culture, a like set of workers. So
now, Volvo did do that, right? Wasn't it at Kalmar, though, I thought they did the team concept?
At Uddevalla.
Uddevalla? Okay.
Yes. And actually, I had a chance to interview two of those workers. And what they said is kind of like what I learned from my nephews. The average was about 1.5 months to learn to put a quarter of a car together. Some people could do the whole car in a month. They'd learn it. And some people, a year later, they're still stumbling and making mistakes. And so not everybody is going to be a craftsman. Not everybody is going to be a mechanic. I have three nephews, all about the same age, and I would give them wooden puzzles every year at the holidays, and they would assemble them. But I tried to graduate it more difficult for the older one. And lo and behold, the youngest one, he put his back together. The other two would tire of it. He'd go over and put this one together and put this. He, to me, was the most likely to be a craftsman. But he went off to business school, and he now runs a grocery store. So.
Uh-oh, went to business
so
school.
Much for that theory.
Bob Lutz would even tell us that would ruin him. hey, we got another phoner here. Let's bring it in.
Hey, John, we're from San Diego. Yeah, the new system is they're talking about is not too unlike what we use in aerospace, although you could automate it a little bit more with the chassis coming in on one of the movable carts that they have today, and then you would just load from the top or the sides with some CNC equipment to come in and load it and be positioned by the craftsman, and it would move on. And that way you can work on multiple vehicles at the same time without one stopping the other, so you wouldn't have to stop and start the assembly line. Thanks.
Well, good. Yeah, thanks for that comment. Kind of interesting.
Yes, that's the fact that people are supporting this idea gives me courage to keep going with this thing. Maybe somebody will do it.
Well, good. Well, look, we're at the top of the hour here. It's probably a good time to wrap up. But Duncan Dayton, great having you here. I mean, more power to you. I would, you know, Peter and I flipped out about this race car when it first came on the scene a couple of years ago. So it's so cool to have you here talking about it.
Well, thanks. Thrilled to be here. And we'll look forward to seeing you at the track.
Great. And Tom, thanks for coming in and talking about your book, because boy, I really think you're onto something with this. I hope somebody in the industry takes it to heart and decides, hey, how do we do a little pilot program? How do we start growing this thing? And I'd love to see it blossom from there.
John, I've enjoyed this very much. Peter, thank
Good
you very much.
You.
It's cool. And Peter.
Now we're going to go out to 101 or whatever it is outside.
Oh, yeah. It's blistering hot out there. Blistering hot out there. But come visit us in January when it's, you know, about 100 degrees difference.
All I can say is I'm not complaining. It's better than February. That's all I can say.
So great seeing you, Peter.
It's good to be back. We'll see you next week, everybody.
Yeah. And just for everybody watching, we're going to have Jay Barron here next week from the Center for Automotive Research. Great guy. Really knows a lot about what's going on in this industry. Don't forget, folks, that you can find us at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. And definitely go to autoextremist.com and read all Peter's stuff there. And thanks for joining us tonight. We'll see you next week.
Visit our website, OutOfLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with OutOfLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with OutOfLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OutOfLineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.